Memorial Mania. Track 1. Introduction. This walk is presented as a series of audio tracks, narrated by me, Tamdeen Byrne, and Ruth Milne. Directions will be given at the beginning of each track. The guide begins at the foot of the street called Calton Hill. Stay at this point beside the bins, facing uphill, just above Calton Road, and with your back to the Black Bull pub. Here you are pointing east.
Abbey, Calton, Castle Grand, southward see St. Leonard's stand, St. John's and Sheen's as two are given, and Moultrie's makes seven.
Many of the old hills of Edinburgh have been built over into obscurity and are now hidden beneath piles of housing and offices. Builders and architects have taken advantage of naturally defensive strongholds presented by other mounds of rock and have constructed castles, both real and imitation. The naturally obstructive character of Calton Hill and its proximity to the higher, more easily defensible Castle Rock has meant that its green scalp remains exposed, that is, except for the observatory buildings and the smattering of monuments which sit on top. The Castle Rock was built up over centuries into a fortress and citadel, an architectural manifestation of defence. In contrast, Calton Hill hosts monuments to people who were lost in military defence of the realm, and also in the struggle by radicals for democratic rights. Stay where you are at the bottom of the hill. Track 2. Calton.
Calton. Calton. Calton. Craigengelt. Craig End. Dow Craig. Black Craig. Cooladun. Call done.
In the higher part of the precipitous lane, running up in front of you and now called Calton Hill, a row of houses clings to the northern side of the street, on the left. These buildings show where the old village of Calton crept up from the foot of the hill in the 18th century and indicate the highest extent of the village. Earlier buildings centred on St. Ninian's Row, where Calton Road is now traversed by the tall arch of the Regent Bridge. You should be able to see this if you turn to your right. Regent Bridge has Waterloo Place running over it. Before works were started here in 1815, there was no bridge and no immediate access to Calton Hill. Now turn back and start walking up the hill. The area of Greenside, along the side of the hill to your left, behind the 18th century houses and these early 21st century offices, had been a designated area for tournaments and outdoor theatre since the 15th century. In the 16th century, Greenside saw the establishment of the White Friars Monastery, and it was nearby that two heretics, David Straton and Norman Gourlay, were burnt at the stake. The White Friars Monastery later became a leper hospital with its own gibbet, on which to hang any poor soul who tried to escape. Stay on the main cobbled road. Robert Burns Clarinda, Agnes McElhose, for whom he wrote A Fond Kiss, lived at number 14 High Calton and was visited here by Jean Armour, the poet's widow. A fond kiss, and then we sever. A farewell, alas, forever. You'll see a small obelisk behind some black railings on your left, which marks her gatepost. By the time these houses on the left side of the street were built in the 1760s, Calton was an established area of Edinburgh with its own burial ground. Calton had its own incorporation of trades, many of whom were shoemakers, known as cordoners. The city of Edinburgh had bought most of the hill in 1724, declaring it public parkland, and it continued to be used for grazing. 18th-century prints and drawings show the residents perambulating on a series of paths. Just before the top of the street is the Parliament House Hotel. Take note of the gate to the left of its entrance. You might want to come back at the very end of the walk to visit this part of the old Calton burial ground. When you come to the top of the street and its junction with Regent Road, stop walking and listen to the next track. Track 3, Regent Road. You are now on Regent Road, at the top of the street, Calton Hill. On your far left, you should be able to see the slopes of Arthur's Seat, and across the road to your right, the Martyrs' Monument, the blackened obelisk in the old Calton burial ground. You are now facing St. Andrew's House, the large, imposing 1930s building that is on the south side of the road. St. Andrew's House was purpose-built for the Scottish Office, which after devolution became the Scottish Executive, then being rebranded the Scottish Government by the incoming SNP administration of 2007. As Edinburgh's new town was established in the 18th century, the buildings encircled Calton Hill, setting up a series of picturesque views. The beginnings of major new development here on the hill itself came with the construction of a new prison on the site where St. Andrew's House now stands. Other jail buildings would follow, but the first was a Bridewell, a correctional institution or House of Public Discipline, designed by Robert Adam and completed in 1796. Debtors and felons' prisons were added alongside, to become the imposing castellated complex of the Calton Jail, positioned opposite the actual castle in the Edinburgh Cragscape. If you look through past the right-hand side of St. Andrew's House, through the gateposts, you'll see the last remaining building of the jail. The cluster of turrets abutting the perimeter wall of the old Calton burial ground is the Governor's House. These later buildings of the Calton Jail had an almost kitsch quality, mimicking the fierceness of a fortress designed to keep people out, rather than contain them. Amongst the inmates held at Calton Jail were the last pirates to be executed in Scotland, before they were hung within the flood mark at Leith, in front of a crowd of tens of thousands. Political prisoners were also incarcerated here. In 1914, the force feeding of artist and suffragette Ethel Moorhead took place. Moorhead was a renowned figure in the Scottish suffragette movement due to the creative forms of militancy she employed, attacking those who denied her democratic right, including Winston Churchill, with such items as eggs, cayenne pepper, and dog whips. During the First World War, the conscientious objector Arthur Woodburn was imprisoned at Calton. During the Second World War, Woodburn was again at Calton, but by this time most of the prison buildings had been demolished and St. Andrew's House was here, where Woodburn was the boss, the Secretary of State for Scotland. It is said that he installed in his garden some flagstones liberated from the old prison as paving. Even after the first prison building was completed in 1796, the Calton Hill was still an unpopulated bit of Edinburgh. The wide view that you can see to the west, to your right, down Waterloo Place and along Princes Street, didn't exist. There was no road here until the Regent Bridge was built. Calton Hill was not linked to the city in the way it is today. Being away from the centre, and a large open space made it a place of assignations and rendezvous, political activity and meetings. This did not end with the physical and administrative incorporation of the hill into the city. Turn left. You'll come to a set of steps. Climb to the fifth step. The best view is from the right-hand side as you go up. Stay here on the steps and go to the next track. Track 4, Colton Hill, Climbing the Hill. Stay where you are on the steps for a moment. If you look to the left of St. Andrew's House, you can see the slopes of Whinny Hill, which is part of Arthur's Seat. Arthur's Seat is the remains of a large volcano. Colton Hill was once part of those slopes and part of the volcano, but much has happened to the landscape here since it last erupted. Now turn your back on Regent Road and climb the remaining steps. As you climb, you are now more than halfway up Colton Hill. On your left, you'll see the gate to Rock House, where the pioneering photographers Hill and Adamson worked. You are now moving through alternate layers of volcanic rock formed from ash, called tuff, and lavas. The lavas here are muggiarite, a type of basalt named after Muggiary on the Isle of Skye, where it was first identified. You'll see a set of steps on your right. Stop just before them. You'll see there's a clear seam in the rock between the two different types. These layers were laid down on top of older sedimentary rock by successive eruptions of the volcano at Arthur's Seat. Volcanic activity began here around 340 million years ago, during the Carboniferous era. Colton Hill was once part of the slopes, the cone, of the Arthur's Seat volcano. Now take the steps and path up the hill. All those hundreds of millions of years ago, as Colton Hill was formed by the volcano, lagoons were a prominent feature of the landscape here. Tens of millions of years after the intermittent volcanic eruptions on Arthur's Seat had finished, a fault line, the Colton Fault, split and displaced Colton Hill from the side of the extinct Arthur's Seat volcano. Later, inundation by water and sand, both washed and blown in, covered Colton Hill and its surroundings in deep sedimentary rock. Later still, slow erosion wore the landscape down into rolling hills, given shape by the underlying hard volcanic rock. This landscape was not at all like the craggy, dramatic Edinburgh of today. It was not until much, much closer to the present day that the igneous rock of Colton Hill, Arthur's Seat and Castle Rock were revealed again from under their sandstone blanket. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, geologists, some working here in Edinburgh, began to realise that Scotland's landscape owed much of its appearance to ice, and that the last of the ice ages had been relatively recent, ending gradually between 15,000 and 9,000 years ago. The glaciers that formed and the rocky waste that they dragged along gouged and carved out the softer sedimentary rock lying on top of the earlier volcanic formations, and even parts of the buried volcanoes themselves. At Colton Hill, it is clear that the glacier moved west to east. As you come up the hill on the path, with your back to the city centre, you are following roughly the same direction as the slow flow of ice. This memorial to volcanism has remained where softer sedimentary rock has been ground away. You should now have come out of the path and be facing the towering Nelson Monument, with the observatory buildings to your left, a little bit up the hill. Go forward to the cannon and start the next track. Track 5. The Monuments.
You mount by stairs in a cutting of the rock to find yourself in a field of monuments, wrote Robert Louis Stevenson in 1879.
You are at the cannon. Take the left fork in the path up toward the observatory. Stop at the Playfair Monument. Turn and stand with your back to the monument. Wait here. And so you have arrived at the Calton Plateau. Excavations by glaciers produced this landscape, to which we have added our own rock formations. At Calton, during the first part of the 19th century, this was manifested in a spree of memorial mania. In his weekly magazine Household Words in 1855, Charles Dickens, though impressed by the quality of Edinburgh's working-class tenements, was less taken with the monuments on Calton Hill. "There is the Calton Hill, littered over with waste fancies, a rubbish heap of imaginative architecture. A hill to be looked from with an elevation of the spirit, but to be looked at with an elevation of the nose." Although he also enjoyed looking out from Calton Hill, like Dickens, Stevenson wasn't convinced of the architectural merits of all its monumental inhabitants. The Nelson Monument, the inverted telescope tower in front of you, was a butter churn, less aesthetically pleasing than nearby industrial chimneys. The monument commemorates naval hero Nelson, who died at the Battle of Trafalgar, where the British Navy had decisively beaten French and Spanish forces in 1805. The monument was finished in 1816. Calton Hill was on the tourist itinerary from the early 19th century, perhaps encouraged by the first ever panorama, painted by Robert Barker, which had been exhibited in London and Edinburgh. Although French visitors weren't always delighted to find a triumph in sandstone erected to celebrate the defeats of their navy. Along with the taller monuments is Playfair's low-lying City Observatory of 1818, the building behind you. The earlier Gothic Observatory is the castellated building along to your right, at the edge of the hill, which looks out over the city centre. This older building has lava rock escaping up from its foundations and was initially designed by James Craig, with some help from Robert Adam. It was almost immediately superseded by the City Observatory built next door, behind the perimeter wall. A key reason that the City Observatory was established was to give accurate time, becoming a place where naval captains would come up from the busy port of Leith to set their timepieces. Later, this watch setting could be done from a distance, by sight of the time ball on top of the Nelson Monument, which drops daily at 1 p.m., or by hearing the 1 o'clock gun fired from the castle. If you look at the Nelson Monument now, and the stour on what is actually very pale stone, you will see why the main observatory was moved out to Blackford Hill in the south of the city in 1895. Air pollution in central Edinburgh had become extreme, and astronomers were no longer able to observe the stars through the sooty atmosphere of old Reiki. Running out of funds and thwarted ambition coincide in the most prominent structures on Calton Hill. The Nelson Monument was funded by initially enthusiastic public subscription, but ran out of cash, stalling building works for a number of years. Instead of housing disabled seamen, as planned, rooms in the tower were leased to caterers who sold pies and other refreshments to visitors. The National Monument, to your left, is a grand name for the 12 Doric columns rendered beautifully in Craigleith sandstone. It is more commonly known as Edinburgh's Disgrace. It should have been a replica of the Parthenon, a new church dedicated to the memory of those sailors and soldiers who lost their lives during the Napoleonic Wars. The cost was to be footed by public subscription. Beneath the church, catacombs were planned as a suitable place to house the remains of great Scots, a Scottish Valhalla. No expense was spared in the planning by the committee, who included Walter Scott, or by the architects, Cockerill and Playfair. Work at the National Monument was abandoned in 1829, after 3 years and with less than half of the appealed-for sum raised. Subsequent campaigns to finish the work, and even connect it to Regent Road by funicular, came to nothing. its incompleteness now seems a happy accident. As you look across to the National Monument, you see a line of large stones neatly arranged along the edge of the path. These are foreigners, brought here by a glacier. They are erratic boulders, belonging to the rocks of Kirstorfen Hill, several miles away. If you turn and look back along Princess Street and beyond the city centre, you can see the wooded outline of Kirstorfen Hill in the distance, known as Clary Wids to those of us who grew up there. The other monuments scattered on the plateau include the 1825-6 blocky Neo-Greek tomb behind you, attached to the observatory wall. This commemorates John Playfair, astronomer and professor of mathematics at Edinburgh University, and was designed by his nephew, William Playfair. Also Greek-inspired, just above the path where you climbed the hill, and once again by Playfair, is the rounded monument built in 1831 in memory of the philosopher Dugald Stewart. Notwithstanding some of the financial difficulties, everything here is seemingly uncontroversial. Monuments to Playfairs designed by Playfairs, celebration of victories and lamentation of losses, Walter Scott involved in almost everything. So far, so Edinburgh. Instead of a planned programme of monuments, it is quite easy to think of the set of toy buildings here as a haphazard collection of unrelated and forgotten ornaments. But there is a latent political scheme. Amongst the memorials to respectable sons of Edinburgh and the popular causes proposed by them, Calton Hill had become the place to be for a monument. From where you are standing, you can see the tip of the Martyrs' Monument obelisk rising up above the trees, just above the cutting where you arrived on the hill. Now turn your back on the National Monument and walk along the path beside the observatory wall, keeping it on your right. Stop outside the round tower of the Gothic Observatory. When you get to the low, rocky wall, and before the path curves to the right. A proposal for another monument on top of Calton Hill was rejected in the 1840s. This was for a skyscraping sandstone obelisk dedicated to the memory of five political radicals, the so-called Scottish political martyrs of the 1790s. In 1794, William Skirving, Thomas Muir, Maurice Marlborough, Joseph Gerald and Thomas Fish Palmer were deported to the penal colony at Botany Bay, Australia, on convict ships. All had been found guilty of sedition, inciting rebellion against the British state. Only one of the martyrs would return to Britain alive. The men were members of a new type of radical political organisation, the Corresponding Societies. These were formed across the United Kingdom in order to campaign for electoral reform, inspired by the French Revolution of 1789. William Skirving was a founder member of the Scottish Society of the Friends of the People, formed in the summer of 1792, in Fortune's Tavern, just off the Royal Mile. Later that year, and into the next, the Society held a series of national conventions in Edinburgh for political reformers. These conventions would lead to the arrest, trial and transportation of all the Scottish martyrs. In 1790s Edinburgh, only 33 men were eligible to vote in general elections. The small Edinburgh electorate was made up entirely of members of the town council, which was in turn comprised of representatives of the trades, a few baileys, and a handful of local dignitaries. From 1790, the Member of Parliament for Edinburgh, which was unique amongst the Scottish cities in having its own MP, was Henry Dundas, the first Lord Melville. Melville was called King Harry IX on account of his seemingly all-pervasive powers. It is said that he was in control of almost all of the 45 Scottish Westminster constituencies. From your viewpoint at the Gothic Observatory, looking across the city, you'll see a statue of Melville, turning his back on Calton Hill and rising high out of St. Andrew's Square on a 152-feet column. The Melville Monument was modelled on Trajan's Column in Rome. Lord Melville was known as a scourge of the radicals and was appropriately disinclined towards their cause of male suffrage. "It would be easier to reform hell," was his comment on the matter of electoral reform. The Attorney General at the time of the martyrs' prosecution was Melville's nephew, and Melville himself endorsed the extreme sentencing of the five men. Even the hand-picked jury expressed shock at the severity of the sentences, which ranged between 7 and 14 years transportation to Australia. Questions were also raised in Westminster. As Home Secretary, it was Melville himself who authorised their deportation by convict ship. The surprise. The hawk still stands on his perch in St. Andrew's Square, scrutinising the city, and part of a constellation of public monuments and statues, many of which were erected within 50 years of each other.
Were I a chosen councillor, a tetrarch of the town, I'd drag from off their pedestals these Tory statues down. I'd make a universal sweep of all that serves to show how vilely the aristocrats have used us long ago.
Now turn your back on the city centre and walk back towards the National Monument. In the years after 1789, a panic took hold of the British establishment. Any attempt at political reform or discussion of it was quickly stamped upon. Printing presses were licensed. Even mention of liberty could mean being branded a Jacobin or a dangerous sympathiser with the tradition-raising French revolutionaries. Dugald Stewart, the philosopher who is commemorated in the circular Greek monument here on the hill, was under suspicion of radical tendencies for lecturing on the theory of liberty. In Scotland, the term Blackneb, or Blakeneb, was a name for a radical or revolutionary. Even 50 years later, in the 1840s, after the political martyrs had been pardoned, when a memorial to them was suggested, the presence of their obelisk was too much, too controversial for the Tory powers that were. The National and Nelson monuments commemorated defence against France and its eventual defeat. This martyr's monument polluted the accepted narrative of the existing commemorations, both here on the hill and around Edinburgh. It was a memorial to those who had opposed the war against France, who were inspired and radicalised by its newfound liberty. Rising out of the rock on Calton Hill with an accusatory sharp point, the proposed martyr's obelisk was a largely unwelcome, unashamedly progressive political voice in the comfortably conservative dialogue of monuments and statues around the city centre. The martyr's monument was a political erratic, and its supporters were not able to transport it quite to the top of the hill. You should now be at the National Monument. Start the next track. Track 6, Gatherings. You're now going to walk over to the Democracy Cairn, which is almost at the end of the meadow that runs beyond the National Monument on the right-hand side. Head past the National Monument, keeping it on your left, with the city centre behind you and Arthur's Seat to your right. When the tarmacked path curves left, continue straight ahead over the grass downhill. The small cairn with a fire basket on top will come into view. Calton Hill is a centuries-old gathering place. In 1988, the Festival of Beltane was revived, inspired by the ancient pagan festival and an echo of the Robin Hood Games that were held on the 1st of May every year in the late Middle Ages. I took part in a couple of the Beltane Fire Festivals as the Blue Man. head to toe in blue makeup, just a little loincloth on, and two big branches to clear a path through all the revellers for the May Queen and her white women entourage. Quite incredible experience. 15,000 people up there through the night, dancing and drinking away with no set security at the time at all. It sort of calmed down a little bit now, but it was a quite wonderful event to take part in. Attempts by the post-Reformation church to ban these Robin Hood games caused several outbreaks of rioting in Edinburgh. The festivities sound like a curious mixture of ribaldry, led by an abbot of misrule, and quasi-religious ceremony. The Cordoners of Calton also held their feast of King Crispin, their patron saint, on the hill with a procession and dinner in their convening rooms. Amongst the pageant and commemoration, more ordinary occupations took place during the day. Until the 19th century, the hill functioned as communal washing green and place to beat carpets. One objection in the 1710s to the siting of the new burial ground was that the preferred south-facing slope was an excellent place for bleaching fabric. In the early 20th century, the hill and its collection of military objects, including old cannons and a World War I tank, also functioned as a playground for local children, escaping cramped Leith tenement life. Make sure you leave the tarmacked path and walk down across the grass to the cairn, not round the hill towards the sea. When you get to the cairn, wait there till this track finishes. As the movement for electoral reform grew, Calton Hill and also Holyrood Park, which you can now see in front of you, became places for political meetings. In the 18th and early 19th century, preachers and political figures spoke here to an audience of as many as 20,000. During the 1830s, a wide variety of reformers began to use the site as a rallying spot. In 1833, anti-annuity tax demonstrations began here. In 1835, the Irish political leader and campaigner for Catholic emancipation, Daniel O'Connell, addressed a large meeting on the slopes. By the end of the decade, radical working men had also begun to hold meetings here. In the later 20th century, Calton Hill became something of a nationalist symbol. Due to the presence of the old Royal High School building, a possible parliament, the building is obscured by bushes, but is just beneath where you are, on the slopes to your right. Regent Road, where the Royal High stands, become shorthand for the campaign for devolution and independence, so much so that the first Minister of Scotland, Donald Dewar, referred to Calton Hill as a nationalist shibboleth. The nationalist connotations of the Royal High School were too much for it to house the devolved Parliament under New Labour. No meetings of the newly elected MSPs were ever held there. In 2004, on the 9th of October, as the new Holyrood Parliament building was opened by the Queen, an alternative event was held on Calton Hill, organised by the Scottish Socialist Party. The Declaration of Calton Hill was released. This called for full independence from Westminster.
We the undersigned call for an independent Scottish Republic built on the principles of liberty, equality, diversity and solidarity. These principles can never be put into practice while Scotland remains subordinate to the hierarchical and anti-democratic institutions of the British state.
I also took part in this event as an alternative queen on the stage, giving what I think is the closest I've ever done to stand-up comedy as Her Lowness. On the 21st of September 2013, there will be another nationalist rally at Calton Hill, the Rally for Scottish Independence. The continuation into the 21st century of Calton Hill as a symbol of Scottish nationalism is interesting to think about in the context of the political martyrs and the electoral reform movement. Although they are referred to as the Scottish political martyrs, only two of the men were Scottish. The others were English, emblematic of the collaborative nature of reformers and radicals in the United Kingdom at this time. The Edinburgh Convention, held in 1792 and 93, were destinations for radicals from across Scotland and England. Liberty and freedom in this context were not used as separationist terms, but as basic demands in the fight for the vote.
May the people awake to the recognition of their rights. Have the fortitude to demand them, the fortune to obtain them, and henceforth sufficient wisdom and vigour to defend them.
You should now have reached the democracy cairn. Stop here and have a look at the cairn before starting the next track. Track 7. 21st Century Monuments and Salisbury Crags. You are now standing beside the Democracy Cairn. The Martyrs Monument, to commemorate the political radicals transported to Australia, finally found its place lower down Calton Hill, in the old Calton Burial Ground, which we will visit on this tour. Near to the originally intended site of the obelisk is the newest of all the monuments on the hill, and by far the smallest, the Democracy Cairn. Between 1992, the fourth consecutive Conservative electoral victory at Westminster, and 1997, when Scotland voted in favour of devolution, a vigil for a Scottish Parliament was held on Regent Road near St Andrew's House. The Democracy Cairn marks the last stages of the journey towards the referendum, with stones from Ben Nevis, Robert Burns' home at Mochlin, Robert Bruce's castle at Loch Marbin, a Paris pavement, and Auschwitz. The latter is dedicated to victims of the Holocaust, and in particular to Jane Haining, one of only two women to be marked on this hill. Haining was a Scottish teacher and missionary who died in Auschwitz, having been captured in Budapest, working with Jewish children. Now turn back towards the larger monuments, and following the path along the edge of the hill on your left, head for the viewpoint, which faces Salisbury Crags. There's a bench and information board there. Wait there till the end of the track.
A fulmet-infested escarpment, bending like a boomerang, north-eastward from Arthur's Seat. Salisbury Crags loom large in the Edinburgh landscape. The crags are possibly the finest example in Scotland of an igneous sill where a sheet of molten tessianite has been intruded along the horizontal bedded strata of the earlier sandstones. The radical road skirting the base of the crags was largely due to that good Tory Sir Walter Scott, who, having immortalised Holyrood Park in the heart of Midlothian in 1818, employed a destitute group of radical West of Scotland weavers to break their politics as much as stones. This historical anecdote is memorialised in the local tongue twister, "Round and round the radical road the radical rascal ran." How many R's are in that?
It has been suggested that the same weavers from the west of Scotland worked on paths here at Calton Hill. Weavers were very well represented in the political reform movement and corresponding societies, becoming almost synonymous with radical politics. They were at the forefront of the Radical War, a five-day insurrection in 1820. Three leaders were executed. Others met the same fate as the earlier martyrs and were transported to Australia. It is not clear that Sir Walter Scott had direct involvement with the work at the Crags, but in contemporary maps of Edinburgh, the path under Salisbury Crags begins to be marked as the Radical Road in the 1820s. Perhaps it is simply the fact that weavers worked on the crags that gave the road its name. Salisbury Crags were also the catalyst for some progressive thinking in geology. James Hutton noticed here that older sedimentary rock had been penetrated by younger volcanic rock, This helped him to argue against prevailing biblical and Neptunist theories of geology. Neptunists proposed that all rock was sedimentary, laid down in a massive ocean. Hutton's ideas were not accepted by many at the time, but his findings came to form the basis of modern geology. The layers of rock that you are standing on top of now were formed from lava and ash from two vents off the Arthur's Seat volcano, now Edinburgh's mini mountain. The stepped rock of the summit of Arthur's Seat is the remains of lava that plugged the vent of the Lion's Head. From the Salisbury Crags viewpoint, head back to the main monuments and down off the hill the way that you came up. Stop when you get to the bottom of the steps on Regent Road, opposite St. Andrew's House. Track 8. The Old Calton Burial Ground and the Martyrs' Monument. You are at the bottom of the steps on Regent Road. Now cross the road. Take care, don't rush. On the other side, turn right, past the gates, and follow the tall stone wall along to the entrance of the Old Calton Burial Ground. We'll give you a bit of time to get there. When you reach the entrance to the burial ground, go up the steps. The Old Calton Burial Ground was consecrated in 1718, after the Calton trades had petitioned for a more convenient location to bury their dead. Tradesmen feature prominently amongst the earliest graves in the cemetery. Almost 100 years later, Waterloo Place, the street you have just come from, was created by blasting through the graveyard. The other remaining section of the old burial ground is marooned on the opposite side of the road. Robert Stevenson, grandfather of Robert Louis Stevenson, was the engineer of the project. Inconveniently interred bodies, including some of the engineer's own children, were exhumed and moved. The burial ground walls, built at the same time, are holding the graveyard in, as is indicated by the damp and mould on the stonework. Continue forward to the Martyrs' Monument, the soot-covered obelisk squeezed into the middle of the burial ground. On the right-hand side of the graveyard, you'll see the large stone drum, philosopher David Hume's grave. When Hume was buried here in 1776, the hill was still parkland. The prisons had not yet been built. Hume's monument was ensured prominence. Because the Calton Burial Ground was not attached to any church, in the 1770s it was by far the most secular place in Edinburgh to be buried. Where could be a better resting place for the great infidel, who had remained unrepentant in his atheism right up to his death? It is said that Hume's grave had to be guarded after his funeral and that the curious hid here at night to see if demons would come for his remains. The funeral of Hume was one of the first of the celebrity interments here. The Waterloo Place project meant that the cemetery became increasingly populated with the remains of a different sort of person, those that lived in the new town. By the time that the proposers of the Martyrs' Monument bought a plot here in the 1840s, the burial ground had become a much grander concern than a cemetery for the Craigenders of Calton. Having been eventually turned down by the council for a spot on top of Calton Hill, the focus of the monument moved here. But once more consternation rose amongst those less radically minded inhabitants of the city, whose relatives were interred in Old Colton. There would be no mortal reformist dust to mingle with worthies underground, but, as all Edinburgh residents knew, pollution could be airborne. The proposal to erect monuments to the Scottish political martyrs in Edinburgh and London had first been mooted by journalist Peter Mackenzie in The Scotsman, but was taken forward by Joseph Hume, Radical MP. A public campaign was launched to raise funds. Note that the public fundraising campaigns were successful, not true of all the Colton Hill monuments. On the side of the Martyrs' Monument facing the cemetery gate, above the fluted base, are the names of the five men whom it commemorates. These men were, by and large, not so very different from those who are remembered on other stones in the graveyard. All the martyrs were well educated, and most were from comfortable backgrounds, and were prosecuted in a series of show trials during 1793 and 1794. Thomas Muir, the most well-known of the martyrs, was a successful Edinburgh lawyer who had grown up a merchant's son near Glasgow. He was the first to be tried and sentenced for sedition after addressing the first convention of the corresponding societies. Thomas Fish Palmer was an English Unitarian minister working in Dundee who had attended Eton College and Cambridge University. He was prosecuted on account of his involvement in the publication of a reformist pamphlet by Dundonian weaver George Mealmaker. William Skirving was the son of a farmer from Liberton near Edinburgh. Skirving had begun training for the ministry before returning to agriculture. He was also arrested for his part in distributing George Mealmaker's pamphlet. Maurice Margarot, a cosmopolitan Englishman, was living in France at the beginning of the Revolution. He was a delegate to the convention from the London Corresponding Society. He amused the populace, if not the prosecution, by processing to his trial from his lodgings at the foot of Colton Hill with a crowd of supporters and under a Tree of Liberty banner shaped like a giant M. Joseph Gerald, also English, was the well-travelled son of an Irish plantation owner. Like Margarot, he came to Edinburgh as a delegate to the National Convention from the London Corresponding Society. At his trial, he dressed in French revolutionary garb, sporting an open collar and unpowdered hair. Margarot was the only one of these five men who would manage to return to the United Kingdom, 16 years after deportation. Skirving and Gerald died in Australia. Palmer died of dysentery in the Western Pacific on his journey home. Muir only spent a couple of years in Australia, escaping in 1796. He arrived in France a year later, missing an eye and part of his cheek. He joined other British radicals at their colony in Paris, but died in France in 1799, aged 33. The martyrs weren't a completely united band of men. They each had different political standpoints. Though some did maintain close contact in Australia, there were disputes on the journey and after arrival. Of course, other men met a similar fate for their radical activities, notably George Mealmaker, whose writings had been the reason for two of the martyrs' arrests. Mealmaker was later transported to Australia, where he died. It seems curious that he is not mentioned on the Martyrs' Monument. Perhaps it was because, as a weaver, he was of a different sort to the others. Mealmaker was also associated with the United Scotsmen, described almost universally as a shadowy organisation. Have a look up at the monument.
Is not every day adding a new link in our chains? Is not the executive branch seizing new and warrantable powers? Has not the House of Commons, your only security from the evils of tyranny and aristocracy, joined the coalition against you? is the elections of its members either fair, free, or frequent? Is not its independence gone while it is made up of pensions and placemen? You are plunged into a war by a wicked ministry and a compliant parliament, who seem careless and unconcerned for your interest, the end and design of which is almost too horrid to relate. The destruction of a people merely because they will be free, by your commerce is sore, cramped, and almost ruined. Thousands of your fellow citizens, from being in a state of prosperity, are reduced to a state of poverty and misery.
50 years after the deportation of the martyrs, the laying of the foundation stone of their monument here at the Old Calton Burial Ground on the 21st of August 1844 was a peaceful affair, but not devoid of spectacle. Joseph Hume and a group of supporters gathered and a sealed time capsule was buried. As the ceremony took place here, another gathering on Calton Hill marked the laying of the monument's foundations. 400 reformers and supporters of the People's Charter, the Chartists, processed from the meadows, dressed in black, to join a gathering of 3,000 on Calton Hill. Their route passed Parliament Square, where 4 of the 5 martyrs had been tried. The Chartists' meeting, which took place up amongst the monuments at the top of the hill, was of a slightly different flavour to that here in the burial ground. The correct monument to the martyrs, it was argued, was not necessarily one of stone, the done thing of the time, but a continuation of their campaign for the right to vote.
Shall we, the children of reform, withhold our just applause from those who love the people and, of course, despise the laws? We'll rear a stately monument, we'll build it fair and high, and on the porch this graven verse shall greet the passers-by. In honour of the martyrs who the battle first began, for the cause of just fraternity and the equal rights of man.
Even 50 years after their deportation to Australia, the martyrs were still capable of splitting opinion, and so did their monument. Although these campaigners for democracy were eventually remembered in stone, others weren't. There is no monument here to any suffragette. Universal suffrage was not achieved in the United Kingdom until 1928, when all women over the age of 21 were given the vote. Calton Hill's prominent position in the landscape of Edinburgh means that it is still being built over by political ideas. Layers of history are blown in, sometimes settling long enough to be petrified into a monument. There is a dense dialogue of ghosts and ideas up here, people and stones. But there are other people who have played a part in the life of this hill and our wider political history, whose memory has been almost completely, if not entirely, eroded. Time doesn't honour all people with rock formations, but the hill is still recording our political geology. The tour is now finished. If you would like to visit the oldest extant grave in Old Calton of Cordoner Thomas Robertson, who died in 1720, go back across the road and round to the gate beside the Parliament House Hotel that you saw earlier. The grave is in the far right corner and shows the cordoner's emblem of crown and leather worker's knife. If you need to hand back your listening device, return to the top of the hill.